So we're leaving the citizens of Alaska with the liability to clean up all these messes if we don't get a bigger bond.
State regulators want more bonds from oil companies to clean up after the well is done producing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 9th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a refugee story of happy endings.
So now I can pay my rent. I can buy my clothes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT now or enroll online at AlaskaQuitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
President Donald Trump's transition team ordered Environmental Protection Agency employees to limit participation in an Alaska environmental conference this week. The Alaska Forum on the Environment has gathered more than 1,000 people in Anchorage to discuss topics ranging from rural drinking water and sanitation to climate change. Executive Director Kurt Ilo says he got a call just 3 days before the conference opened.
On Friday, the day Friday this past week, we got a phone call from the local office of EPA, and we were informed that EPA was directed by the White House transition team to minimize their participation in the Alaska Forum on the Environment to the extent possible.
In an emailed statement, transition official Doug Erickson said the decision was an effort to limit excessive travel costs at the EPA. He said the agency decided to cut the number of employees attending from 34 to 17. Some EPA staff who didn't make the conference would have come from Seattle or Washington, D.C. But Ilo says some EPA staff based just blocks away in downtown Anchorage were also told not to attend. Ilo says EPA worked hard to minimize disruption, and only one of the conference's more than 100 sessions was canceled because of the change. But he says the decision has raised concerns.
There's a lot of uncertainty amongst the folks here at the forum. There's concern about their tribal programs. There's concern about how we're going to address things like climate change in the next upcoming administration. But we really don't know that.
Ilo says it's the first time in the 19-year history of the conference he can recall this happening, and the decision comes on top of a series of actions that have unnerved some of EPA's partners, including the decision to remove some information about climate change from the EPA website. The former head of the EPA transition recently told the AP he'd like to see the agency's staff cut in half. The city of Anchorage launched a new open data portal. The website is designed as a one-stop shop for the public to get information that's already collected by the municipality, but not always easy to find. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Inside a conference room at City Hall, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz sums up the logic of his administration's push to get public information out in front of residents.
It's really particularly important in a changing world that we have a dynamic form of civic engagement. And when you have open data, it creates a portal for that civic engagement, and it allows the public sector also to harness public information.
This is a wonky way of saying that sometimes your best ideas about how to govern a city come from innovative citizens. Since taking office, the Berkowitz administration has consistently tried to improve municipal services by tinkering with them internally. That's included measures like bringing social service providers together to boost efficiencies, all the way to interactive maps on snow plowing and streetlights. Many of those efforts fall under the city's Open Data Initiative, which is steering resources towards tech innovation, much of it overseen by Brendan Babb, the city's chief information officer. Babb looks excited as he rattles off the data sets that have been compiled and collected at a simple website that just launched.
We're highlighting restaurant inspection data, some childcare inspection data, and we'll also have property appraisal and parcel data.
Next to Babb is a poster displaying the website where all this stuff now lives. There are data sets on crime and homelessness there, too. The idea, Babs says, is to have the city's health inspection data more easily integrated into a website like Yelp, so people have more information to make a decision about where to eat. Or having childcare inspection results easy to find when a parent's looking for daycare options. Part of Babs' job is working with different city departments to get more and more data sets pulled into the portal and waiting to see what members of the public do with it, whether that's finding unspotted patterns, developing new apps, or other totally bizarre applications that nobody can even imagine yet.
And this is just the beginning. We're going to be adding data throughout the year. I think it'll allow people to really explore the data and ask additional questions.
Decisions about which information sets to prioritize will be made by what Bab calls an open data governance committee, comprised of 5 municipal employees and 5 members of the public. The portal website is live now. It's powered by a Seattle-based company called Socrata that specializes in opening government data. And with just a few clicks, you can see the assessed value for a parcel of land, any health code violations at your favorite restaurant, and more. It's at data.muni.org. That's data.muni.org. In ANC, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The agency that oversees oil and gas drilling in the state says it doesn't collect nearly enough money to clean up wells in case companies walk away. Regulators say the recent influx of small private companies means Alaska risks shouldering the cost of abandoned wells. State lawmakers are receptive to addressing the issue. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Cleaning up after an oil or gas well in Alaska isn't cheap. Normally, the company that drilled the well is responsible for plugging it up. But if the company goes bankrupt and can't pay, the state of Alaska foots the bill. So Alaska requires companies to hand over a $100,000 to $200,000 bond before they start drilling, kind of like a security deposit. But according to Kathy Forrester, who chairs the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, that's not nearly enough money.
The bonding that operators have for well liability in the state of Alaska is woefully inadequate.
Forrester estimates it can cost up to $20 million to clean up a well in Alaska, thanks to our remote, challenging drilling environment. Forrester says for a long time, bonding wasn't a big issue because Alaska was dominated by huge public oil companies. The state wasn't worried about Exxon not having the cash to clean up the wells, for example. But new tax incentives attracted a wave of small private oil and gas companies. That's when Forrester started to get nervous.
It's a whole different playing field. We have little companies that we don't know, you know, what their capability for liability coverage is and when they might just disappear in the night.
Last year, 2 companies operating in Alaska, Aurora Gas and Link Energy, went bankrupt. According to state data, there are currently 33 wells owned by Link and Aurora that state inspectors haven't yet confirmed are properly plugged and abandoned. Some of the 33 wells are still producing, but they still need to be cleaned up at some point. Forrester says if bankrupt companies can't pay for cleanup and the bond doesn't cover the cost, Alaska ends up paying.
So we're leaving the citizens of Alaska with the liability to clean up all these messes if we don't get a bigger bond.
This week, Forrester is in Juneau to talk to lawmakers. Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson, who co-chairs the House Resources Committee, was alarmed when he heard what Forrester had to say.
It's not enough. The bonds are not enough. And I'm sort of amazed that we would set up a system where companies could either walk away from a lease or declare bankruptcy, and we're left holding the bag.
The Oil and Gas Conservation Commission doesn't need a new law to raise the bond amount. But Josephson says lawmakers might consider adding language in the recently introduced oil and gas tax bill to address the issue. Republican Senator Kathy Geisel, who chairs the Senate Resources Committee, also heard from Forrester on the issue.
Her concern is probably a justifiable one. $200,000 isn't a lot.
Geisel says she's not sure the legislature needs to get involved. She says she will rely on the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's experts to take the lead on the issue. Kara Moriarty, who advocates for the industry as head of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, says the industry isn't surprised the issue came up, and it's willing to discuss a fix. But Moriarty wants to make sure the bond amount doesn't become a barrier.
We need to make sure that it does not prevent a smaller company from entering the market or being dissuaded from investing in Alaska.
Forrester says she's not sure how much more companies should pay in bonds. She says it's possible it could be flexible depending on the company and the project. But she's certain something needs to change. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what the fog, Anchorage? Find out why Alaska's largest city is experiencing a hazy shade of winter.
There's no other winter that's had this many days of dense fog.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The American Society of Civil Engineers graded Alaska's infrastructure for the first time, releasing the report card on Tuesday. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
On average, the rest of the country is sitting at a D-plus for things like bridges, roads, and water systems. It makes Alaska's GPA look pretty good. We scored an overall C. But Greg Kinney, with the Alaska branch of the American Society of Civil Engineers, says we're not off the hook yet.
It's a mediocre grade. Looking at it from a positive light, as a parent, you say to your child that you can do better.
Falling into that mediocre group is Alaska's energy grid. It scored a C-minus for reasons you might expect. Parts of rural Alaska still run on diesel, but there are problems in urban areas too. Kinney says electric utilities around the state need to do a better job of working together, especially in Rail Belt Alaska.
There are bottlenecks currently, particularly in the transmission lines, which have not kept pace with the generation capacity.
When that occurs, Kinney says you get steeper electric rates. It's a problem the Regulatory Commission of Alaska identified last year. In January, three Anchorage area power companies agreed to work together. And Kinney says that's the kind of collaboration his organization wants to see. It could boost the state's energy grade beyond a lukewarm score. But there are other areas dragging down Alaska's overall GPA, like the Marine Highway System, ports and harbors, and access to clean drinking water, all Ds.
A D represents significant elements of the system being at risk of failure or nearing failure.
According to the report card, more than 30 rural communities have no centralized water or wastewater systems. And Kinney thinks those that do could benefit from more routine maintenance. A spokesperson for Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation agreed. The agency helps train people who monitor the water, but it said federal funding is needed to ensure those workers can stay in rural parts of the state. But if Alaska has one thing going for it, Kinney says it's that the state infrastructure was built from decades worth of oil money, so it's relatively new.
This is really what we're trying to achieve here is how can we get newer infrastructure to actually stay new.
And as the state grapples with a multi-billion dollar hole to fill because of oil, Kinney's organization realizes that could be a challenge. He says they support measures like increasing the state's motor fuel tax to help Alaska's infrastructure make the grade. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska law bars the state government from spending money to comply with the federal Real ID Act. Starting in June, the federal government will require Alaska residents visiting military bases and other federal facilities to have ID cards that meet Real ID standards. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on legislation that would make Alaska comply with the federal law.
Under House Bill 74 and Senate Bill 34, Alaska residents would be able to choose one of two driver's licenses, one that complies with Real ID and one that doesn't. The bills also would allow the state to spend money to comply with Real ID and to charge residents $5 to offset some of the costs. The information on Real ID compliant licenses would be in a new database that's shared with other states. Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, sponsored the 2008 law that blocks Alaska from spending money on Real ID. He says the federal government should bear the costs and shouldn't punish Alaskans by denying them access to military bases and flights.
I think that's offensive. I think it's heavy-handed. I think it will cost the state millions to implement. And I hope our federal delegation can and the Trump administration will put an end to that practice.
26 states comply with the federal law. Alaska is one of 19 that received extensions as a result of legislation that would put it in compliance. 5 states aren't complying. On January 30th, some federal facilities began denying access to those states' residents who don't have passports or other IDs that comply with Real ID. Alaskans who only have driver's licenses that don't comply with Real ID won't be able to enter military bases and other federal buildings beginning on June 7th. They won't be able to board commercial flights next January unless the state passes the bill. If it does pass the bill, Alaskans will have until October 2020 to get Real ID compliant cards. Congress passed Real ID in 2005. It included provisions aimed at making it more difficult for people in the country illegally to get driver's licenses and to make boarding aircraft more secure after the September 11th attacks. At a House State Affairs Committee meeting on Tuesday, representatives from both parties expressed opposition to the federal law. Anchorage Republican Gabrielle Ledoux says the federal law could actually make identity fraud more likely.
To the extent that it is there to prevent identity fraud, I would think that having everybody's information in a database is more likely to cause identity fraud.
State officials noted that personal information on the state's current driver's licenses already is available to officials in other states. No more information would be available through the Real ID licenses. Ledoux says the federal government has put the state in a difficult position. She compared the database to those with credit card information that have been hacked.
It makes me uncomfortable. And yet at the same time, you got to be able to fly.
Governor Bill Walker proposed the bills. State Department of Administration Deputy Commissioner Leslie Rydell says the bills are intended to give Alaskans options. She says many people who aren't paying attention to the issue may be affected.
They're going to want to jump on a plane for a vacation and not have a passport or any of these other types of IDs that will allow them to fly.
The committee didn't take action on the bill. The Senate bill was referred to the Senate State Affairs Committee. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Refugee stories are often about fear, people fleeing their homes because they fear for their safety, but they can also be stories of joy. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has the story of one woman's path from war to love and finally to Anchorage.
Marie-Claire Mukumbambunje fled Rwanda during the genocide in 1994, only to find herself caught up in the war in the neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo. For months, she walked more than 300 miles through the dense forest with a group of other civilians and some soldiers. They were trying to escape areas of fighting. During that time, she was forced to marry a soldier and stayed with him for 4 turbulent, violent years. Together, they had a son. When aid agencies finally helped her escape the forest and relocate to Congo Brazzaville, she wasn't free of her violent husband.
After 1 month, 2 months, he can come. And then he go in the forest, and then he back again.
She worried he would try to kill her. But this isn't that story. This is the story of how she met her current husband, Faustine Murengezi, and they came to be sitting with their children in an apartment in Anchorage, remembering the past. Marie-Claire was working in a hospital in Congo Brazzaville and living alone with her son. One of her coworkers knew she was single, so he brought his friend, Faustine, to visit her. Faustine proposed that day, but the way Marie-Claire saw it, she didn't need a husband.
So now I can pay my rent, I can buy my clothes. What do you need? If you ask me you love me, what do you need to do for me, especially?
Marie-Claire's first marriage was miserable. She feared going home. Why should she try it again?
I live for 4 years with someone here who was fighting every day. I never feel like love.
But Faustine came back to see her at the hospital, this time alone. And he told her all about his past life, how he taught in Rwanda and was a person of faith. He was married before, too. But when fleeing the fighting in the forest, he was separated from his first wife. He waited for her for 6 years before accepting that she had probably died. Marie Claire says her friends told her to give him a chance.
Start again your life. Don't stay like this. You are you're still youngest. You can start your life, and then life can be good for you. I was always refused.
She decided to pray about it. Then one night, she dreamt that someone was coming to attack her and her son in their apartment, just like her former husband had done.
I scared maybe someone is coming again. I wake up, no person. 3 times. And then the second time, I hear a voice for him. He say, "This is my wife. If I saw you again here, you and me fight." Ah, what is this?
In her dream, it was Faustin's voice that she heard telling the attacker to go away. Marie Claire says she couldn't go back to sleep and went in the morning to see her pastor. The pastor said maybe it was a sign from God. She never dreamed of being attacked again. Soon after the dream, they were married. Marie Claire says being with Faustin is very different than her first marriage. He cares for her.
He's funny. He's like, very, I see big difference.
Together, they had 3 more children, but they were not safe in Congo Brazzaville. Her first husband tried to kidnap her oldest son. The family applied to be resettled into a new country, and about a year ago, they arrived in Anchorage. Marie Claire sits with her husband on the couch, remembering how people described Alaska to her.
It's very, very cold.
Very cold. Mm.
Yeah. Cold, no cold. For me, I need to be in a safety place.
Yeah. Mm.
Now she is safe, working full-time as a housekeeper at the Marriott and training new employees, while Faustine, who used to teach and work in public health, attends classes and looks for another job. They lean together on the couch, posed a lot like they are in the wedding photo that hangs on the wall right above them, one of the few belongings they carried to help make Anchorage their home. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at Rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Yukon Quest frontrunner Brent Sass got back on the trail this morning after completing the 36-hour break mushers must take at the race's halfway point in Dawson City, Yukon. Sass remains in the lead as of this afternoon. Sass was followed about 4 hours later by Hugh Neff, with close-running Matt Hall and Alan Moore about another 2 hours back. Quest officials shared some sad news this morning, announcing that a sled dog had died. Race Marshal Fabian Schmidt said Quest veteran Yuka Honda arrived in Dawson with the expired animal early this morning.
At around 4 o'clock, dog marshal Yuka Honda came into the Dawson checkpoint and informed the race official on duty that she had an expired dog in her sled bag. And the vet team took over. We have a pathologist. They performed necropsy.
Preliminary necropsy results released later this morning show the 6-year-old male husky named Firefly had an enlarged heart and had ingested several dog booties. Final necropsy results will be available in coming weeks. Quest mushers may face extreme cold during the second half of the race. National Weather Service meteorologist Christopher Cox says a low-pressure system from the high Arctic is forecast to descend over interior Alaska this weekend. Quest mushers travel a route along the Yukon and 40-mile rivers, as well as notoriously cold Birch Creek during the second half of the race. Anchorage has had a record amount of dense fog this winter. The main culprit is a dramatic temperature inversion between the mountains and the city. On average, it's been 9 degrees warmer on the upper hillside than in town. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with climatologist Brian Brettschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. This week, we're responding to a listener who asked, "What the fog? Why has there been so much fog in Anchorage this winter?" Brettschneider told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit, "You have to go back to 1950 to find a winter that comes even close to the number of days with dense fog."
starting at December 1st, we've had at least 26 days where there's been dense fog. So that's one quarter mile visibility or less. And looking back through the records, all the way back to 1925, there's no other winter that's had this many days of dense fog. There's been some winters that had more days of fog that maybe wasn't as dense, particularly 1950, but no winter has had even this has been this close in terms of the number of dense fog days.
So what's going on here? What's causing so much fog this year?
We've got a couple things going on. Here at the surface, we've been pretty cold. We've been 4 or 5 degrees below normal for most of the winter. But if you go up 1,000 feet, 1,500, 2,000 feet, it's been quite warm. And so that's called a temperature inversion. And if you look back at using weather balloon soundings, you have to go back to 1950 to find a year where there's been a bigger temperature inversion than 2017 so far. When you're in a situation like that, the air really doesn't have any buoyancy. It can't rise. So if you have moisture trapped at the surface, it has nowhere to go. You need the cooler air aloft or you need some wind to push it out. And we've had neither. So it just kind of stays around until there's something to move it out of the way.
Are there other contributing factors like geography in Anchorage?
Yeah. So, you know, we have this moisture source that's right next to us. We have Cook Inlet. We've also had a lot of snow. And we don't think about snow evaporating. But when we do get snow, some of it evaporates into the air, and that provides additional moisture. And so we've got this confluence of moisture sources. And then we also have high mountains on several sides of Anchorage that really trap that moisture in place.
As the winter naturally warms up with more sun, will we have as much of this fog?
So when you might have noticed during the daytime, there's less fog. So with the higher sun angle, we're actually able, the sun's energy is actually able to warm the surface up. And that means when you warm up the air, it's able to hold more moisture, and then you don't see the fog. And then as it cools down back at night, the ability of the air to hold moisture decreases and it resaturates. So as the sun gets higher and higher up, you end up with less hours of fog during the daytime, which is different than what you see in December and early January, where there's essentially no solar energy. So that fog can really stick around all day long.
Brian Retschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Elizabeth Jenkins, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Molly Reddick in Dawson City. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.